Chapter 2. Here's what the Encyclopedia Galactica has to say about alcohol. It says that alcohol is a colorless, volatile liquid formed by the formation of sugars, and it also notes its intoxicating effects on certain carbon-based life forms. The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy also mentions alcohol. It says that the best drink in existence is the Pangalactica Gargle Blaster. It says that the effect of drinking a Pangalactic Gargle Blaster is having your brain smashed out by a slice of lemon wrapped around a large gold brick. The guide also tells you on which planets the best Pangalactic Gargle Blasters are mixed, how much you can expect to pay for one, and what voluntary organization exists to help you rehabilitate afterwards. The guide even tells you how you can mix one yourself. Take the juice from one bottle of the old Jack Spirit, it says. Pour it into one measure of water from the seas of Centragus V and the Centragian seawater, it says. Oh, the Centragian fish. Allow 3 cubes of Arcturian Megagen to melt into the mixture. It must be properly iced or the benzene is lost. Allow 4 liters of Fallon marsh gas to bubble through it, in memory of all those happy bikers who have died of pleasure in the marshes of Pallia. Over the back of a silver spoon, float a measure of the Coolactin Hypermint extract, redolent of all the heady odors of the dark Coolactian zones, subtle, sweet, and mystic. Drop in the tooth of an Algonian sun tiger. Watch it dissolve, spreading the fires of the Algonian suns deep into the heart of the drink. Sprinkle Zampir and add an olive. Drink, but carefully. The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy sells rather better than the Encyclopedia Galactica. 6 pints of bitter, said Ford Perfect to the barman of the Horse and Groom, and quickly, please, the world's about to end. The barman of the Horse and Groom didn't deserve this sort of treatment. He was a dignified old man. He pushed his glasses up his nose and blinked at Ford Perfect. Ford ignored him and stared out the window. So the barman looked instead to Arthur, who shrugged helplessly and said nothing. So the barman said, "Oh yes, sir, nice weather for it," and started pulling pints. He tried again, "Going to watch the match this afternoon, then?" Ford glanced around him. "No, no point," he said, looking back out the window. "What's that foregone conclusion, then, you reckon, sir?" said the barman. "Arsenal without a chance?" "No, no," said Ford. "It's just that the world's about to end." "Oh, yes, sir, so you said," said the barman, looking over his glasses this time at Arthur. "Lucky escape for Arsenal if it did." Ford looked back at him, genuinely surprised. "No, not really," he said. He frowned. The barman breathed in heavily. "There you are, sir. 6 pints," he said. Arthur smiled at him wanly and shrugged again. He turned and smiled wanly at the rest of the pub. Just in case any of them had heard what was going on. None of them had, and none of them could understand what he was smiling at them for. A man sitting next to Ford at the bar looked at the 2 men, looked at the 6 pints, did a swift burst of mental arithmetic, arrived at the answer he liked, and grinned at a stupid, hopeful grin at him. "Get off," said Ford. "They're ours," giving him a look that would have made an Algonian sun tiger get on with what it was doing. Ford slapped a 5-pound note on the bar. He said, "Keep the change." "What? From a fiver? Thank you, sir. You've got about 10 minutes to spend it." The barman decided simply to walk away for a bit. "Ford," said Arthur, "would you please tell me what the hell is going on?" "Drink up," said Ford. You've got 3 pints to get through."
3 pints? Said Arthur. "At lunchtime?"
The man next to Ford grinned and nodded happily. Ford ignored him. He said, "Time is an illusion. Lunchtime, undoubtedly so." "Very deep," said Arthur. "You should send that to the Reader's Digest. They've got a page for people like you." "Drink up." "Why 3 pints all of a sudden?"
"Muscle relaxant. You'll need it."
"Muscle relaxant?"
"Muscle relaxant."
Arthur stared into his beer. "Did I do anything wrong today?" he said. "Or has the world always been like this and I've been too wrapped up in myself to notice?" "All right," said Ford. "I'll try to explain. How long have we known each other?"
"How long?" Arthur thought.
About 5 years. Maybe 6, he said. "Most of it seems to make some kind of sense at the time."
All right, said Ford. How would you react if I said I'm not from Guilford at all, but from a small planet somewhere in the vicinity of Betelgeuse?
Arthur shrugged in a so-so way. I don't know, he said, taking a pull of beer. Why do you think that it's the sort of thing you're likely to say? Ford gave up. It really wasn't worth bothering at the moment. What in the world, with the world about to end? He said, drink up. He added, perfect factuality, the world's about to end. Arthur gave the rest of the pub another wan smile. The rest of the pub frowned at him. A man waved at him to stop smiling at them and mind his own business. This must be a Thursday, said Arthur to himself, sinking low over his beer. I can never get the hang of Thursdays. Chapter 3. On this particular Thursday, something was moving quietly through the Innosphere many miles above the surface of the planet. Several somethings, in fact. Several dozen huge, yellow, chunky, slab-like somethings, huge as office blocks, silent as birds. They soared with ease, basking in the electromagnetic rays from the star's soul, binding their time, grouping, preparing. The planet beneath them was almost perfectly oblivious of their presence, which was just how they wanted to be for the moment. The huge yellow something went unnoticed at Goon Hilly. They passed over Cape Canaveral with a bit. Rumera and Jodel Bank also looked straight through them, which was a pity because it is exactly the sort of thing that they had been looking for all these years. The only place they registered at all was a small black device called a sub-etha sensomatic, which winked away quietly to itself and nestled in the darkness inside a leather satchel which Ford Perfect habitually wore slung around his neck. The contents of Ford Perfect's satchel were quite interesting, in fact, and would have made any Earth physicist's eyes pop out of his head, which is why he always concealed them by keeping a couple of dog-eared scripts for plays he pretended he was auditioning for stuffed at the top. Besides the sub-etha sensomatic and the scripts that he had, an electric thumb, a sort of squat black rod, smooth and matte, with a couple of flat switches and dials at one end, he also had a device that looked rather like a large electronic calculator. This had about 100 tiny flat press buttons and a screen about 4 inches square on it, which any of millions of pages could be summoned at a moment's notice. It looked insanely complicated. This was one of the reasons why the snug plastic cover it fitted into it had the words "Don't Panic" printed in large font letters. The other reason that this device was in fact the most remarkable of all books ever to come out of the great publishing corporation of Ursa Minor, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, the reason why it was published in the form of a micro-sub-Meissen electronic component is that if it were printed in a normal book form, an interstellar hitchhiker would have required several inconveniently large buildings to carry it around in. Beneath that, in Ford Perfect's satchel, were a few ballpoints, a notepad, a large bath towel from Marks and Spencer's. The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy had a few things to say on the subject of bath towels. A towel, it says, is about the most massively useful thing an interstellar hitchhiker can have. Partly has great practical value. You can wrap it around you for warmth as you bound across the cold moons of Gaglin Beta. You can lie on its brilliant marble sanded beaches of Centragius V, inhaling heaty sea vapors. You can sleep under it beneath the stars which shine so readily on the desert world of Cacrafoon. Use it to sail a mini raft down a slow, heavy river moth. Wet it for use in hand-to-hand combat. Wrap it around your head to ward off noxious fumes, or avoid the gaze of the ravenous bug bladder beast of Trowel, a mind-bogglingly stupid animal. It assumes that if you can't see it, it can't see you. Daft as a bush, but very, very ravenous. You can wave your towel in emergencies as a distress signal, and of course dry yourself off with it if it still seems to be clean enough. More importantly, a towel has some immense psychological value. For some reason, if a strag non-hitchhiker discovers that a hitchhiker has his towel with him, he will automatically assume that he is in possession of a toothbrush, washcloth, soap, tin of biscuits, flask, compass, map, ball of string, gnat spray, wet weather gear, spacesuit, etc., etc.
Furthermore, the Strag will then happily lend the hitchhiker any of these or a dozen other items that the hitchhiker might have accidentally lost. What the Strag will think is that any man who can hitch the length and breadth of a galaxy, rough it, slum it, struggle against terrible odds, win through, and still know where his tail is clearly a man to be reckoned with. Hence the phrase that has passed into hitchhiking slang, as in, "Hey, you sass that Hoopy Ford perfect? That's a fruit who really knows where his tail is. Sass? No. Be aware of. Meet. Have sex with. Hoopy. Really together guy. Fruit. Really amazing together guy." Nestling quickly on top of the tail in Ford Perfect's satchel, the sub-ethos sensomatic began to wink more quickly. Miles above the surface of the planet, the huge yellow somethings began to fan out. As Jordal Bank, someone decided it was time for a nice relaxing cup of tea. "You've got a towel with you?" said Ford, suddenly to Arthur. Arthur, struggling through his third pint, looked round at him. "Why? What? No. Should I have?" He had given up being surprised. There didn't seem any point any longer. Ford clicked his tongue in irritation. "Drink up," he urged. At that moment, the dull sound of rumbling crashed from outside, filtered through a low murmur of the pub, through the sound of the jukebox, through the sound of the man next to Ford hiccuping over whiskey. Ford had eventually bought him. Arthur choked on his beer, leaped to his feet. "What's that?" he yelped. "Don't worry," said Ford. "They haven't started yet." "Thank God for that," Arthur said, relaxed. "It's probably just your house being knocked down," said Ford, drawing his last pint. "What?" shouted Arthur. Suddenly, Ford's spell was broken, and Arthur looked wildly around him and ran to the window. "My God, they are. They're knocking my house down." "What the hell am I doing at the pub, Ford?" "It hardly makes any difference at this stage," said Ford. "Let them have their fun." "Fun?" yelped Arthur. "Fun?" And quickly checked out the window again to make sure they were talking about the same thing. "Damn their fun," he hooted, and ran out of the pub furiously, waving a nearly empty beer glass. He made no friends at all at the pub at that lunchtime. "Stop, you vandals, you homewreckers," bawled Arthur. "You half-crazed Visgoths, stop, will you?" Ford would have to go after him. Turning quickly to the barman, he asked for four packets of peanuts. "There you are, sir," said the barman, slipping the packets on the bar. 28 pence, if you be so kind." Ford was very kind. He gave the barman another 5-pound note and told him to keep the change. The barman looked at it and then looked at Ford. He suddenly shivered. He experienced a momentary situation that he didn't understand, because no one on Earth had ever experienced it before. In the moments of great stress, every life form that exists gives out a tiny subliminal signal. This signal simply communicates an exact and almost pathetic sense of how far that being is from the place of his birth. On Earth, it's never possible to be rather 16,000 miles from your birthplace, which really isn't that far, so the signals are too minute to be noticed. Ford Perfect was at this moment under great stress. He was born 600 light years away in the near vicinity of Betelgeuse. The barman reeled for a moment, hit by the shocking, incomprehensible sense of a distance. He didn't know what it meant, but he looked at Ford Perfect with a new sense of respect and almost awe. "Are you serious, sir?" he said in a small whisper, which had the effect of silencing the pub. "You think the world's gonna end?" "Yes," said Ford. "But this afternoon..." Ford had recovered himself. He was at his flippiest. "Yes," he said gaily. "In less than 2 minutes, I would estimate." The barman couldn't believe the conversation he was having, but he couldn't believe the sensation he had just had either. "Is there anything we can do about it, then?" he said. "No, nothing," said Ford, stuffing his peanuts into his pocket. Someone in the hushed bar suddenly laughed raucously at how stupid everyone had become. The man sitting next to Ford was a bit sozzled by now. His eyes weaved their way up to Ford. "I thought," he said, "that if the world was going to end, we were meant to lie down or put paper bags or something like that over our head." "If you'd like, yes," said Ford. "That's what they told us in the army," said the man. His eyes began a long trek towards his whiskey. "Will that help?" asked the barman. "No," said Ford, and gave him a friendly smile. "Excuse me," he said. "I've got to go." With a wave, he left.
The pub was silent for a moment, longer than then, embarrassingly enough. The man with the raucous laugh did it again. The girl he had dragged along to the pub with him had grown to loathe him dearly over the last hour, and it would probably have been of great satisfaction to her to know that within a minute and a half or so, he would suddenly evaporate into a whiff of hydrogen, ozone, and carbon monoxide. However, when that moment came, she too would be busy evaporating herself to notice. The barman cleared his throat. He heard himself say, "Last orders, please." The huge yellow machines began to sink downwards and move faster. Ford knew they were there. This wasn't the way he had wanted it. Running up the lane, Arthur had nearly reached his house. He didn't notice how cold it had suddenly become. He didn't notice the wind. He didn't notice the sudden irrational squall of rain. He didn't notice anything but the caterpillar bulldozers crawling over the rubble that had been his home. "You barbarians," he yelled. "I'll see you in the council for every penny it's got. I'll have you hung, drawn, and quartered, and whipped, and boiled, until you've had enough." Ford was running after him very, very fast. Very, very fast. "And I'll do it again," yelled Arthur. "And when I've finished, I'll take all the little bits, and I'll jump on them." Arthur didn't notice that the men were running from the bulldozers. He didn't notice that Mr. Prosser was staring hectically into the sky. What Mr. Prosser had noticed was that these huge yellow somethings were screaming through the clouds. Impossibly huge yellow somethings. "And I'll carry on jumping on them," said Arthur, still running, "until I get blisters or I can think of anything that's more unpleasant to do. And then..." Arthur tripped and fell headlong, rolled, and landed flat on his back. At last, he noticed that something was going on. His fingers shot upward. "What the hell is that?" he shrieked. Whatever it was raced across the sky in a monstrous yellowness, tore the sky apart with mind-boggling noise, and leapt off into the distance, leaving the gasping air to shut behind it with a bang that drove your ears 6 feet into your skull. Another one followed and did exactly the same thing, only louder. It was difficult to say exactly that people on the surface of the planet were doing now, because they didn't really know what they were doing themselves. None of it made a lot of sense, running into houses, running out of houses, howling noises at noise. All around the world, city streets exploded with people, cars skidded into each other, and noise fell on them, and then rolled off like tidal waves over hills and valleys and deserts and oceans, seemingly to flatten everything it hit. Only one man stood and watched the sky, stood with terrible sadness in his eyes, rubber bungs in his ear. He knew exactly what was happening, and he had known ever since the sub-ethos sensomatic had started winking in the dead of night beside his pillow and wakened him with a start. It was what he had waited for all these years. But when he had deciphered the signal pattern, sitting alone in his small dark room, a coldness had gripped him and squeezed at his heart. Of all the races in the galaxy, who could have come and had said a big hello to the planet Earth? He thought, didn't it have to be the Vogans? Still, he knew what he had to do. As the Vogan craft seemed screamed through the air high above him, he opened his satchel. He threw away a copy of Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. He threw away a copy of Godspell. He wouldn't need them where he was going. Everything was ready. Everything was prepared. He knew where his towel was. A sudden silence hit the earth. If anything, it was worse than the noise. For a while, nothing happened. The great ships hung motionlessly in the sky. Over every nation on Earth, motionless they hung. Huge, heavy, steady in the sky. A blasphemy against nature. Many people went straight into shock as their minds tried to encompass what they were looking at. The ships hung in the sky in much the same way that bricks don't. And still nothing happened. And there was a slight whisper, a sudden spacious whisper of open ambient sound. Every hi-fi set in the world, every radio, every television, every cassette recorder, every woofer, every tweeter, every mid-range driver in the world quietly turned itself on. Every tin can, every dustbin, every window, every car, every wine glass, every sheet of rusty metal became activated as an acoustically perfect sounding board. Before Earth passed away, it was going to be treated to a very ultimate in-sound reproduction and the greatest public address system ever built. There was no concert, no music, no fanfare, just a simple message. "People of Earth, your attention please," a voice said, and it was wonderful. Wonderful, perfect, quadraphonic sound with a distortion level so low to make brave men weep. "This is Protostenik Volgen Jeltz of the Galactica Hyperspace Planning Council," the voice continued. "As you will no doubt be aware, the plans of the development of the outlying regions of the galaxy require the building of a hyperspatial express route through our star system, and regrettably, your planet is one of those scheduled for demolition. The process will take slightly less than 2 of your Earth minutes. Thank you." The PA died away. Uncomprehending terror settled on the watching people of Earth. The terror moved slowly through the gathered crowds as if they were iron filings on a sheet of board, and a magnet was moving beneath them. Panic sprouted again, desperate fleeing panic, but there was nowhere to flee to. Observing this, the Volgans turned their PA again and said, "There's no point in acting all surprised about it. All the planning charts and demolition orders have been on display in your local planning department in the Alpha Centauri for 50 of your Earth years, so you've had plenty of time to lodge any formal complaint, and it's far too late to start making a fuss of it now." The PA fell silent again. Its echo drifts across the land. The huge ships turn slowly in the sky with easy power. On the underside of each hatchway opened an empty black square. By the time somebody somewhere must have manned a radio transmitter located at the wavelength of a broadcast and message back of the Volgan ships to plead on the behalf of the planet, nobody ever heard what they said. They only heard the reply. The PA slammed back to life again. The voice was annoyed. It said, "What do you mean you've never been to Alpha Centauri? For heaven's sakes, mankind, it's only 4 light years away, you know. I'm sorry, but if you can't be bothered to take an interest in local affairs, that's your own lookout." Energized the demolition beams. Light poured out of the hatchways. "I don't know," said the voice of the PA. Apathetic, bloody planet. I have no sympathy at all." It cut off. There was a terrible, ghastly silence. There was a terrible, ghastly noise. There was a terrible, ghastly silence. The Volgan constructor fleet coasted away into the inky, starry void. Chapter 4. Far away on the opposite spiral arm of the galaxy, 500,000 light-years from the star Sol, Zapadoid Beetlebox, president of the Imperial Galactic Government, sped across the seas of the Damogran, his iron-drive Delta boat winking and flashing in the Damogran sun. Damogran the hot, Damogran the remote, Damogran the almost totally unheard of, Damogran's secret home of the Heart of Gold. The boat sped across the water. It would be some time before it reached its destination because Damogran is such an inconveniently arranged planet. It consists of nothing but middling to the largest desert islands, separated by very pretty but very annoyingly wide stretches of ocean. The boat sped on. Because of this topographical awkwardness, Damogran had always remained a desert planet. This is why the Imperial Galactica government chose Damogran for the Heart of Gold project, because it was so deserted and the Heart of Gold project was so secret. The boat zipped and skipped across the sea that lay between the main islands of the only archipelago of any useful size on the whole planet. Zaphod Beetlebrox was on his way from the tiny spaceport of the Easter Island. The name was an entirely meaningless coincidence in the galactic speak. Easter means small, flat, and light brown, to the Heart of Gold Island, which by another meaningless coincidence is called France. One of the side effects of work on the Heart of Gold was the whole string of pretty meaningless coincidences. But it was not in any way a coincidence that day, the day culmination of the project, the great day of unraveling, the day that the Heart of Gold was finally introduced to a marvelingly galaxy, and also a great day of accumulation for Zaphod Beetlebrox. It was for the sake of this day that he had first decided to run for presidency, a decision that had sent shockwaves of astonishment throughout the Imperial Galaxy. Zaphod Beetlebrox, president?
not the Zaphoid Beetlebrox, not the president. Many had seen it as a clinching proof that the whole known creation had finally gone bananas. Zaphoid grinned and gave the boat an extra kick of speed. Zaphoid Beetlebrox, adventurer, ex-hippie, good timer, crook, quite possibly, manic, self-publicist, terribly bad at personal relationships, often thought to be completely out to lunch. President? No. No one had gone bananas, not in that way at least. Only 6 people in the entire galaxy understood the principle on which the galaxy was governed, and they knew that once Zaphoid Beetlebrox had announced his intention to run as president, it was more or less a fait accompli. He was ideal presidency fodder. What they completely failed to understand was why Zaphoid was doing it. He banged sharply, shooting a wild wall of water at the sun. Today was the day. Today was the day that they would realize what Zaphoid had been up to. Today was what Zaphoid Beetlebrox's presidency was all about. Today was his 200th birthday. But it was just another meaningly coincidence. As he skipped his boat across the seas of Damogran, he smiled quietly to himself about what a wonderful, exciting day it was going to be. He relaxed and spread his 2 arms lazily along the seat back. He steered with an extra arm he had recently fitted just beneath his right one and helped improve his ski boxing. "Hey," he cooed himself, "you're a real cool boy, you." But his nerves sang a song shriller than the dog whistle. The island of France was about 20 miles long, 5 miles across the middle, sandy and crescent-shaped. In fact, it seemed to exist not so much as an island in its own right, but as simply a means of defining the sweep and curve of a huge bay. This impression was heightened by the fact that the inner coastline, the crescent, consisted almost entirely of steep cliffs. From the top of the cliff, the land sloped slowly down 5 miles to the opposite shore. On the top of the cliff stood a reception committee. It consisted of a large part of the engineers and researchers who had built the Heart of Gold, mostly humanoid. But here, there were a few more reptoid entomometers, two or three green, self-like maximegaleticians, an optopodic psychostructuralist or two, in a Huvaluvu. A Huvaluvu is a super intelligent shade of color blue. All except the Huvaluvu were resplendent in their multicolored ceremonial lab coats. The Huvaluvu had been temporarily refracted into a freestanding prism for this occasion. There was a mood of immense excitement thrilling through all of them. Together and between them, they had gone to and beyond the furthest limits of physical laws, restructured a fundamental fabric of matter, stained, twisted, and broken the laws of possibility and impossibility. But still, the greatest excitement of all seemed to be meet a man with an orange sash around his neck, an orange sash that was the president of the galaxy traditionally wore. It might not have made much difference to them if they had known exactly how much power the president of the galaxy actually wielded. None at all. Only 6 people in the galaxy knew the job of the galactical president was not a will to wield power, but to attract attention away from it. Zaphoid Beetlebrox was amazingly good at this job. The crowd gasped, dazzled by sun and seamanship, and as the presidential speedboat zipped around the hand landed into the bay. It flashed and shone as it came skidding over the sea in a wide skidding turn. In fact, it didn't need to touch the water at all, because it was supported on a hazy cushion of ionized atoms, but just for effects, it was fitted with thin fin blades, which could be lowered into the water. They slashed sheets of water hissing into the air, carved deep gashes in the sea, which swayed crazily and sank back foaming into the boat's wake as it careered across the bay. Zaphoid loved the effect. It was what he was best at.
He twisted the wheel sharply. The boat skidded round in a wild seething skid beneath the cliff face and dropped to the rest lightly on the rocking waves. Within seconds, he ran out into the deck and waved and grinned at over 3 billion people. The 3 billion people weren't actually there, but they watched his every gesture. And through the eyes of a small robot tri-D camera, which hovered obsequently in the air nearby, the antics of the president always made amazingly popular tri-D. That's what it was there for. He grinned again. 3 billion and 6 people didn't know it, but today would be a bigger antic than anyone had bargained for. The robot camera homed in for a close-up of the more popular of his two heads as he waved again. He was roughly humanoid in the appearance except for the extra head and third arm. His fair tasseled hair stuck out in random directions. His blue eyes glinted with something completely undefinable, and his chins were almost always unshaven. A 20-foot-high transparent globe floated next to his boat, rolling and bobbing, glistening in the brilliant sun. Inside it floated a wide semicircular sofa upholstered in glorious red leather. The more the globe bobbed and rolled, the more the sofa stayed perfectly still, steady in an upholstered rock. Again, all done for the effect as much as anything. Zaphoid stepped through the wall of the globe and relaxed on the sofa. He spread his two arms along the back as the third brushed some dust off his knee. His head looked about, smiling. He put his feet up. At any moment, he thought, he might scream. Water boiled up beneath the bubble, and it seethed and spouted, and the bubble surged into the air, bobbling and rolling on the water spout. Up it climbed, throwing slits of light at the cliff. Up it surged on the jet, the water falling from beneath it, crashing back into the sea hundreds of feet below. Zaphoid smiled, picturing himself. A thoroughly ridiculous form of transport, but a thoroughly beautiful one. At the top of the cliff, the globe wavered for a moment, tipped onto a wild ramp, rolled down it to a small concave platform, and riddled to a halt. To tremendous applause, Zaphoid Beetlebrox stepped out of the bubble, his orange sash blazing in the light. The president of the galaxy had arrived. He waited for the applause to die down. He raised his hand in greeting. "Hi," he said. A government spider saddled up to him and attempted to press a copy of his prepared speech into his hands. Pages 3 of 7 of the original version were at the moment floating solidly on Damagrand Sea, some 5 miles down from the bay. Pages 1 and 2 had been salvaged by Damagrand Fawn Crested Eagle and had already become incorporated into an extraordinary new form of nest, which the eagle had invented. It was constructed largely of papier-mâché, and it was virtually impossible for the newly hatched baby eagle to break out of it. The Damagrand Fawn Crested Eagle had heard of the notion of survival of the species and wanted no truck with it. Zaphoid Beetlebrox would not be needing his set speech, and he gently deflected the one being offered to him by the spider. "Hi," he said again. Everyone beamed at him, or at least nearly everyone. He singled out Trillian from the crowd. Trillian was a girl that Zaphoid had picked up recently while visiting a planet. Just for fun, incognito, she was a slim, darkish humanoid with long waves of black hair, a full mouth, and an odd little knob of a nose and a ridiculously brown eyes. With her red head scarf knotted in a particular way, in her long, flowing, silky brown dress, she looked vaguely Arabic. Not that anyone there had ever heard of an Arab, of course. The Arabs had very recently ceased to exist. And even when they had existed, they were 500,000 light-years from Damagrand. Trillian wasn't anybody in particular, or so Zaphoid claimed. She just went around with him rather a lot and told him what she thought of him. "Hi, honey," he said to her. She flashed him a quick, tight smile and looked away. Then she looked back for a moment and smiled more warmly, but this time he was looking at something else. "Hi," he said to a small knot of creatures from the press who were standing nearby, wishing that he could stop saying hi and get on with quotes. He grinned at them, particularly because he knew what was in a few moments, he would be giving them one hell of a quote. The next thing he said, though, was not a lot of use to him. One of the officials of the party had irritably decided the president was clearly not in a mood to read the deliciously turned speech and that he had written for him, and had flipped the switch onto the remote control device in his pocket, away in front of a huge white dome that bulged against the sky, cracked down the middle, split, and slowly folded itself into the ground. Everyone gasped, as they knew, had known perfectly well that it was going to do that, because they had built it that way. Beneath it lay, uncovered, a huge starship, 150 meters long, shaped like a sleek running shoe, perfectly white, mind-bogglingly beautiful. At the heart of it, unseen, lay a small gold box, which carried within it the most brain-wrenching device ever conceived, a device that made this starship unique in the history of the galaxy, a device after which the ship had been named, the Heart of Gold. Wow, said Zaphoid Beetlebrox to the Heart of Gold. There wasn't much else he could say. He said it again because he knew it would annoy the press. Wow. The crowd turned their faces back towards him expectantly. He winked at Trillian, who raised her eyebrows and widened her eyes at him. She knew what he was about to say and thought of him a terrible show-off. This is really amazing, he said. This is really, truly amazing. This is so amazingly amazing, I think I'd like to steal it. A marvelous presidential quote, absolutely true to form. The crowd laughed appreciatively, and the newsmen gleefully punched buttons on their sub-etha newsmatic, and the president grinned. And as he grinned, his heart screamed unbearably as he fingered the paralysomatic bomb that had nestled quietly in his pocket. Finally, he could bear it no more. He lifted his heads up to the sky, let out a wild whoop in a major thirds, threw the bomb to the ground, ran forward to the sea, and the sea of suddenly frozen beaming smiles. President Fool, title President of the Imperial Galactical Government. The term Imperial is kept through. It is now an anachronism. The hereditary emperor is nearly dead and has been for many centuries. In the last moments of his dying coma, he was locked in the stasis field, which kept him in the state of perpetual unchangingness. All his heirs are now long dead, and that means without any drastic political upheaval, power and simply effectively moved a rung or two down the ladder, and is now seen to be vested in the body that used to act simply as advisors to the emperor. An elected governmental assembly, headed by a presidential elected by assembly, in fact, it vests in no such place. The president in particular is very much a figurehead. He wields no real power whatsoever. He is apparently chosen by the government, but the qualities he is required to display are none of those of leadership, but those of finely judged outrage. For this reason, the president is always a controversial choice, always an infuriating but fascinating character. His job is to not wield power, but to draw attention away from it. One of those criteria Zaphoid Beetlebrox is one of the most successful presidents of the galaxy has ever had. He already spent 2 of his 10 presidential years in prison for fraud. Very few people realize that the president and the government have virtually no power at all. And of these few people, only 6 whence ultimate political power is wielded. Most of the others secretly believe that the ultimate decision-making process is handled by a computer. They couldn't be more wrong.